Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Being forsaken by her husband, Sita Devi entrusted her two sons to the care of Valmiki Muni. Then, meditating upon the lotus feet of Lord Ramachandra, she entered into the earth. Purport. It was impossible for Sita Devi to live in separation from Lord Ramachandra. Therefore, after entrusting her two sons to the care of Valmiki Muni, she entered into the earth. Om Agyantarandasya Gyananjana Sakaya Chakshurunmulitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pustaya Bhutale Shimati Bhaktivedanta Swaminite Namine Namaste Sarvati Devi Gauravani Pacharnini Vishesha Shunyavani Paschadesnarine. So, so much can be said about Ram Leela, about the Ramayana, but I'm just a fool, so I try and say something that might not be substantial. But also, today we're honoring the appearance day of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur Goswami, so I try to include some acknowledgement of his great life in this. So I'd just like to start with the Lord himself. So the Lord's kingdom is perfect and complete in every way, full of transcendental eternity, knowledge and bliss. Everything is absolute. And these qualities we can only begin to conceive of. But although one without a second, the Lord is manifesting himself throughout his creation by his sweet will and for his transcendental pleasure. So we know that from Sri Krishna, the first expansion is Lord Balaram. And from Balaram come the first Chaturvyuha expansions, Vasudev, Sankarshan Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. And they are like the guardians of the four directions of Vaikuntha. Their role is guardians. And from that Sankarshan comes Lord Narayan. And from that Lord Narayan come the second Chaturvyuha expansions, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. And from the second Sankarshan come all the expansions of all the avatars, or the ones who will descend into the material realm from the spiritual world to expand Krishna's will and mercy into the material realm. So we know that Lord Brahma, he said many prayers. He said, Ramadi Murtisho Kalani Amenatishtan Nanavatara Makaro Bhuvaneshu Kintu Krishna Svayam Samabhava Parama Pumanyo Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. So he said, I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who manifested himself personally as Krishna and manifested the different avatars in the world, such as Lord Ram, from his subjective portions. So his subjective portions, like Lord Ram, they come from the Vaikuntha realm, but Krishna comes personally from Golok Vrindavan. So you know that Krishna came personally from Golok Vrindavan just over 5,000 years ago onto this very planet, and he brought Vraj with him, he brought the spiritual world with him. And even though when he left he took the spiritual world back with him, even the dust of that lotus feet still remains there, so we know this is still a sacred place and we can feel it in that way. So those avatars, those ones who will come down into the material world for Krishna's pastimes, there are six types of avatars. So you have the Purusha avatars, so Karanadakshai Vishnu, Mahavishnu, he is really the super soul of all the collected universes. So from him lying down in the causal ocean, trillions and trillions of universes come from his body into the dark cloud, which will become the material world, the material part of creation within the spiritual part of creation. And then Garbhadakshai Vishnu, who will enter into each universe individually. So he'll be the super soul of all the collective living entities within each universe. And then Shiradakshai Vishnu, who will be the super soul in the heart of every living entity. Then we have the Gunavatars. They enter into the material modes. Lord Brahma in the mode of passion, for creating in the mode of passion. Lord Vishnu maintaining in the mode of goodness. And Lord Shiva destroying in the mode of ignorance. Then we have the Yuga Avatars, associated with the dynamics of each particular Yuga. The Manvantara Avatars, who come each rule of Manu, different avatars will come. Shaktivesh Avatars, those empowered with certain rulership responsibilities, like Yamaraj, Lord Buddha, they will come. And then the Leela Avatars who will come, they will be performing the pastimes. So when Sutta Goswami was speaking to the sages of Namasharanya, he said, Eta chamsha kalapum sa krishnas tu bhagavan swayam indrari vakulam lokam mirdianti yuge yuge. So he said, for all these expansions are either plenary portions or portions of the plenary portions of the Lord. But Lord Sri Krishna, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And all of these expansions appear whenever there is a disturbance created by the atheists. So the Lord incarnates to protect the theists in the world. So this is it. Sri Krishna, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everybody else is an expansion or incarnation from Krishna. So these Leela avatars, they will come into the world whenever there's disturbance created by the atheists who come into the material world. And we know that there are innumerable Leela avatars, so many. But for our information, at least 25 main ones have been detailed. And one of them is Dasharati, so the son of Lord Dasharat, who is Lord Ramachandra, who's also known as Janakinath, the husband of Janaki, who's the daughter of Lord Janak. So Lord Ram, he came into this world accompanied by his other expansions and the internal potency in the form of Lakshman, Bharat, and Shatrughna. It's said that Ram himself is Vasudev, Lakshman is Sankarshan, Bharat is Pradyumna, and Shatrughna is Aniruddha. So we know that the Chaturvyuha expansions, they are defenders of the Vaikuntha realm. This is the defensive role. So we can see that. And of course, the internal potency, the goddess of fortune, is Sita Devi. Sita Devi comes with them. And of course, Hanuman, who comes from his father, who is god of the wind god. So they came onto this earth millions of years ago to give the example of righteousness, righteous behavior and righteous rulership, and to deal with the disturbance created by the great atheist Ravana. So that was the purpose. Of course, they're all Vishnu Tattva. So we've been hearing in some of the classes some of the amazing pastimes of Lord Ram from the Ramayana. And many devotees, of course, particularly Indian body devotees who have been born in Hindu, with Hindu backgrounds, these stories are nectar, and some amazing stories come. But I was thinking, in one sense, you know, the real central character of the Ramayana is actually Sita Devi. And the reason for that is because, well, not only is she the symbol of all patience, tolerance, steadfastness, chastity, all these qualities, but she's also the mother of Lava and Kusha. And as we know from this, that when she was left in the forest, she went to the ashram of Valmiki Muni, and he took her in and protected her. And so when she gave birth to Lava and Kusha, then Valmiki Muni, started to write the Ramayana. And Lava and Kusha were there. So this is how the Ramayana is now extended into this present day after millions and millions of years. So I thought to look a bit more at Sita Devi, because here she is avatar of the goddess of fortune. But to begin looking at that, we should really look at the supreme goddess, who is, of course, Srimati Radharani. So just in the same way that Krishna, he's the root of all of expansions, then Srimati Radharani is the root of all the Mahalakshmi expansions throughout the universe, of which Sita is one. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur Goswami, he spoke some interesting things about Radharani. For the first thing was that he always, well, quite often I think, called her Vrishabhanu's daughter, the son of King Vrishabhanu. And I'm kind of assuming here that the reason for that was he's such an elevated Vaishnav that to speak about her in terms of the name Radharani is just too familiar. It's not his place to speak in such a familiar way. So rather he'd call her the daughter of Vrishabhanu. As a great brahmachari, this is it. So maybe we become too familiar, just Radharani. Maybe we're too familiar in some ways. So we should be following, trying to understand where these great Vaishnavas are coming from. So, and he talks more. He said that the Srimad Bhagavatam, someone asked him, why is Radharani not mentioned so much in the Srimad Bhagavatam? And he said, well, she is mentioned, but the reason is that Shukadeva Goswami, knowing this knowledge about Radharani, the daughter of Vrishabhanu, to be such of a secret nature, he didn't want it to be known to ignorant and, adverse people. It should remain a secret. So there's this aspect of the divine feminine nature, which should always, there's a secret nature, it should remain secret for its own protection. And this extends into a devotee woman, she should always be protected. There's always that part. So he talked about her, the Radharani, as being basically the mother of the universe, the supreme goddess, the mother of all energies, the source of all nature, and the sum total of Krishna's various energies. Krishna would have no opulence without the goddess, without the supreme goddess, without that internal potency being there. So the mother is the most sacred symbol, actually. Purity, selflessness, caring, sharing, nurturing, and love. And of course, Radharani is the greatest devotee of Krishna. And so Bhaktisiddhanta, in one speech he actually said, this is amazing, he said, damn those who do not consider the lotus feet of the daughter of Vrishabhanu the most cherished object. Glorious are those who have taken shelter of Vrishabhanu's daughter. If we can take shelter of those who have taken shelter of those who have taken shelter of the daughter of Vrishabhanu, only then will we achieve supreme auspiciousness. The mighty words from a mighty Vaishnav. So just a little bit about Srimati Radharani's appearance, how there's the element of it's unusual, the appearance. So we know that it said in a half moon night, King Vrishabhanu, he went to bathe in the Jamuna River. And then suddenly he was surrounded by a great golden glow, and which was just full of peace. And then he looked and he saw that this glow was coming from a lotus flower which had a baby girl standing on it. So the king went back to the palace with the girl, and he went to his queen Kirtida, and she was very delighted but also very shocked because the girl was blind. So one time soon after, Yashodamai came with baby Krishna. Krishna was a month or two old at this time, to visit the queen and this girl. And at that time, we know that Krishna, he crawled off while they were speaking, and he went up to the cradle containing Radharani, and he leant over to look in. And only then Radharani's eyes opened wide, and it said, eyes like lotuses, blooming lotuses, eyes just opened. So she was not willing to open her eyes. She would have remained blind. She didn't want to come into the material realm. But Krishna, somehow she came. But only, she wasn't interested in seeing this world, but only Krishna, the object of her love. So in one sense, we can look at the appearance of Sita Devi, and we see also, like, similarly, there's quite unusual circumstance of her appearance, that it says she was born of the earth. So born to Mother Bhumi, goddess of the earth, and found in a golden casket buried inside the earth. So in the Sanskrit of the Valmiki Ramayana, that's written Atami krishata kshetram langalad utita mama kshetram sodayata labda namnasiteti vishruta. So King Janak recalled, and he said, and as I was tilling the ground, a girl child came out from under the plough. I gathered her up as I cleared that field, and I've named her Sita after that furrow. Because the Sanskrit word Sita actually means furrow or plough. And she's also called Ayonija, which means she who is of a miraculous birth, not born from the womb. So this is the amazing pastimes, the appearance of Sita. So at this point, I thought to reflect on something a little bit different. And that's, you know, as devotees, we're naturally ready to hear the wonderful words of the scriptures and the beautiful descriptions of the Lord's name, form, pastimes, etc. We're just ready to drink up the nectar. We can read the Bhagavatam and just soak it in. We love it. We're getting the mercy, and it's like the highest nectar. But what about the non-devotees in the world, who are the vast majority of the population of planet Earth, in case we forget non-devotees? So even in India now, it's like, and for some time, in fact, there are many who are actually like skeptical about the histories of the Vedic scriptures, because many people see it. Now we're moving into this seemingly like new age, new time. These things are from the past, when gods and goddesses came on planet Earth. Even if they did, they're not coming anymore. So that time's over. So many people becoming a little bit more skeptical about this. Because in one sense, Krishna appeared only just over 5,000 years ago. Not such a long time, really. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, a mere 500 years ago, hardly anything. But Lord Ram and his associates appeared millions of years ago. Not even this Treta Yuga and this Kalpa, but a previous one. So it took millions and millions and millions of years ago. So such a long passing of time. Yet still, the Ramayana remains within our knowledge. It's preserved. Okay. Through a great long time. But through time, events disappear. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Bhagavan Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Shri Shri Gornitai Shri Madhavrinda Devi Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Many stories have become changed. There are many versions of the stories of the Ramayana now. So some people increasingly think that maybe these things never did happen. Maybe it was just a way that people survived. It was a method of surviving in a previous time. And, you know, the Western skeptics about religion and spiritual path are even worse, of course. There's a different slant on them. You can imagine, you know, it's how they might be thinking that a man is in his house. His wife looks at the overgrown garden and says to the husband, can you do something about that? So he dutifully goes down to B&Q, buys a spade, goes back home, starts digging in the garden. He's digging away, and then suddenly, oh, what's this? A golden casket. I wonder what's inside. You know, this kind of thinking, this like Western thinking. It's just somehow to laugh it off. It's not something that we don't experience things like this, like golden caskets buried in the ground with divine beings inside them. So we can accept it as devotees, but how can anybody else accept these things? They might say, yes, I accept, but then they go away back into the conditioned nature and they completely forget about it, because some will, some won't. So it's not our duty. We can't just ignore them. It's our duty to have like compassion. We need to speak to people to try and help them to understand. So I was thinking in that case, what could we say? Maybe first we could explain about the different cycles of ages, that each age has different properties. If a golden casket containing a divine being turned up now in Kali Yuga, it'd most likely just cause great bewilderment and distress. Probably it would start a third world war. There'd be panic and mayhem. So obviously this is not the time for a divine being to appear on planet Earth. Of course they could, if Krishna wills it. But we can understand also that the Treta Yuga, by its nature, this was suitable for such an appearance. So this is these kind of things. In Kali Yuga, it's more likely, even if we meet someone and we start a new friendship with someone, this itself is an enlightening experience in Kali Yuga. What to speak of meeting directly divine expansions of the Lord. So Srila Prabhupada in Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter, in one of the purports, he talks about the two classes of people amongst the conditioned souls as far as self-realization goes. So the first class is the atheists, the agnostics, and the skeptics. And actually they're beyond any sense of spiritual understanding. But then there are the others who have some faith and understanding of spiritual life. And of course the top most of them are the devotees, because the devotees can understand that beyond the material nature, there's a spiritual world and there's a Supreme Personality of Godhead who is manifesting in the whole thing and who is expanding himself as a super soul in the hearts of every living entity. But for those who are atheistic, agnostic or skeptical, they're tightly bound by their conditioning. As Gopa Kumarapuru was saying on Friday about like the world is now, that the atheists are now actually becoming the new intelligentsia in one sense. The atheists will attract huge crowds to speak about why God doesn't exist and why it's just part of the illusory thing. So they're becoming quite powerful in the world, and it's not a surprise really. But we have the acharyas, we have the scriptures, we have Srila Prabhupada's purports, which give us faith that everything in Shastra is actually correct. So we must be the ones to take our place, to enter a debate, and to give the right conclusions to those who are just actually conditioned. So the devotees at one point were speaking with Srila Prabhupada about one David Hume, who was a Scottish philosopher from the 1700s, no relation to me. And he said that his point was that one actually had to be a philosophical skeptic before he could even accept the revealed truths of religion. And basically that great spiritual truths could only be accepted on the basis of faith and not experience or reason. So Srila Prabhupada said to him, "Oh, and why not reason?" So Srila Prabhupada said, "Because everything has a proprietor or owner. So it's quite reasonable to think that all this vast sky, vast water, vast land, all this nature must have some proprietor, must have some owner. And what's the fault in that logic? What is the fault in that logic?" So, I mean, because scientists say that to begin with there was some substance and there was some gas, all the rest of it. But where did that come from? There must have been some kind of proprietor, some kind of owner behind that. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, "Maya Jakshana Prakriti, this material nature is one of my energies and is working under my direction." This is what we accept as devotees. And Prabhupada continued, actually the argument also comes that if he was not willing to accept anybody else's statement, why should anybody accept his statement? You know, this is it. So the atheist can stand and address great crowds and talk about not accepting God, but what then in turn, why should anyone accept what they're saying? So this is, but they're very conditioned, so they're kind of protected from seeing their foolish position. But we can see their foolish position, and in that position, we're in a strong position to actually give the truth as it is. In fact, most of them is kind of childish. And then there's the atheists. Again, Srila Prabhupada gives a nice example of atheist when he talks about the pastime of actually King Vena from a long time ago. And he was the father of Prithu Maharaj, who was a great soul. But King Venu was condemned by all the Brahmanas and saintly people because he denied the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he rejected the performance of Vedic sacrifice, thinking it was useless. In other words, he was an atheist. So they think there's no need to accept any authority of God. And actually, one can be successful in the practice of Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, in the practice of religion, economic development, sense gratification, liberation. We don't need to rely on any God. They'll just say it happens naturally. So King Venu was saying that actually Dharma, the whole purpose is just to establish an imaginary God, so that which will encourage us to become moral and honest, just so that the social orders might be maintained. It's kind of interesting. And that economic development, this will naturally come. Sense gratification, when we have money, that will naturally come. Liberation, we don't need to think about liberation, because after death it's all over anyway, there's nothing more. So this is the position of the atheist. But Prithvi Maharaj, he knew, and all great personalities would agree with him, that in this world the only bestower of the benefits of religion, economic development, sense gratification and liberation, and elevation to heavenly planets is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the root of everything and supply of everything. So, skeptics and atheists and agnostics are just those who neither believe in God, or they neither believe it or disbelieve it. So they're kind of in between somewhere. So, but as I'm thinking, it's just they're just living by their conditioned nature. They have accepted various arguments, which maybe have come from somebody else, but due to their conditioning, they've been open to that, and they've accepted it as being their own belief. But actually, it's not really their own belief. But how can they find out? Well, they have to hear about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So even though Srila Prabhupada could easily defeat so many atheists and skeptics and agnostics, he's left us with that responsibility to continue this. So can we really do this? Because in one sense the atheists, they don't have so many rivals really, because you could say the religions are full of people who have a lot of faith, but they don't necessarily have a lot of logic and reasoning behind it. It's just faith. So if you try and have a conversation with them, the last point is faith. They don't really care if there's any philosophy or logic or reasoning. They will just rely on faith. So then that only really leaves Krishna's devotees. There's nobody else really who can take care of this. From another angle, Lord Brahma also said in his prayers, he said, Vedasya Durlabha Adurlabha Atma Bhaktau. So he said, I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas, but who is obtainable by pure, unalloyed devotion of the soul. So, Vedasya Durlabham, inaccessible to the Vedas. So many people, particularly, of course, in traditionally Indian culture, they will follow the Vedas, the rituals, and the karma kanda aspect of the Vedas. But they won't necessarily reach such a pure state of devotion. I'm not being critical, but as Kali Yuga progresses, we can see that this is definitely the case. So that the Vedas themselves, the Vedas, the personified Vedas, they're just serving. That this is a means of getting some sense gratification, some auspiciousness. But they're not the Vedas. The words of the Vedas themselves are not going to give Supreme Lord. It's devotion, only devotion. Adurlabhama Atma Bhakto. So only pure devotion of the soul will connect us with the Supreme Lord. So we need to work a little bit harder. So sometimes the pastimes are just not enough. So many people, they can read the pastimes, but we must take the stance of like diving deep into these pastimes and trying to draw out the nectar which satisfies the soul from within the pastimes. Otherwise, the pastimes are just can just be easily and just another story. So it's all about, it's like a lifetime meditation on Krishna. This is under the supervision of a bona fide spiritual master. This is the means by which we can connect our soul with the Supreme Soul. And again, back to Siddhanta Sarasvati, he was explaining this in his amazing grasp of English, as always. He said that basically that limited intellectual function of the jiva, our cognition is so meager, you know, we can hardly understand anything really. So how can that, if that can't realize the transcendental nature, then what can? So he said, I'll just repeat this because it's so good. He said, it's only when the Vedas are imbued with the chit potency that they're enabled to deal with the transcendental. So Golok reveals itself to every jiva soul when he is under the influence of the spiritual cognitive potency joined to the essence of ecstatic energy. The ecstatic function of devotion is boundless and is surcharged with unalloyed transcendental knowledge. Now I'm going to translate that and just chant Hare Krishna under the supervision of the spiritual master and engage in devotional service. I think basically that's what he was saying. But Bhaktisiddhanta he was such an amazing, incredible intelligence. I'll say something a bit more at the end about him, but even his grasp of English, Srila Prabhupada's grasp of English was obviously very, very good, but Bhaktisiddhanta's was inconceivable. How just his great intelligence, how he mastered even the English language, which is so, in one sense, difficult to use. Many European speakers of European languages will tell you that actually English is quite difficult to use, and when it comes to speaking emotional things, English is quite hard to get a grasp of. But Bhaktisiddhanta, he could just speak these words so well. So we are very limited. We are Tatasta Shakti of the Supreme Lord. We're not Chit Shakti, we're not Maya Shakti, we're in between. We're the energy, we're not the energetic. So how can we understand this? Well, Srila Prabhupada gives two nice examples. One is of the sun's rays. So even though there's no qualitative difference between the sun and the sun's rays, still the energy of the sun gives another thing, which is clouds or snowfall, and then the sun is not to be seen. So we can understand in that way that similarly, although we are of the same nature as the Lord, we are attracted by the inferior energy, overpowered by that other energy of the sun, just as the sun is blocked out by clouds and snowfall. So we're attracted by the inferior energy so easily. Or the other one is like the sparks within the fire. The sparks are non-different from the fire, but when the spark jumps out from the fire, it enters the non-fiery atmosphere, and very quickly that spark's in trouble. It's going to go out. So similarly with us, when we lose contact with the fiery, the original fire, then all our misfortune and miseries begin. So this is the story why we're here in the material world. Our misfortune and miseries begin. So because we're this Tatashta Shakti, we can either move towards the spiritual or the material. We have that choice. So we can either choose to dream our illusory dreams within the conditioned nature, or we can steer towards the ocean of eternity, knowledge and bliss. So it's up to us what we want to be. But we, for non-devotees, we shouldn't be so eager to let them continue down their conditioned path, because we know that the result of the destination, we also know where they can end up, and we know that terrible destination. We begin to develop compassion. We don't want them to end up in that place. So we must give these examples to people constantly to try and wake them up somehow. So our devotion must be pure. We want to taste the nectar as much as we can. And there's another nice example that one devotee gave. He said, it's like if we have mixed devotion, it's like trying to enjoy sweet rice that's been mixed with sand. So even though the sweet rice is very tasty and relishable, if we add sand to it, it becomes very unpalatable. We don't want it. So if a devotee has too many material desires, then it's not really devotion anymore. It's mixed. It's devotion to Maya and also devotion to Krishna. It's kind of mixed, so we're somewhere in the middle. So haitiki pratihata yatma supersiditi. So devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So we shouldn't be cheating ourselves out of the nectar of Krishna consciousness, but we need to fully embrace pure devotional service as being our only activity and our only goal. So Lord Ramchandra, he's walking incognito through the city in disguise so that he can hear what people are saying, what their opinion is. And of course, he hears one man who is definitely a very conditioned soul speaking about his wife and how he doesn't want her back because she's been with another man. It's strange, because if there's Treta Yuga, I was under the misconception that everybody was still quite pure in Treta Yuga, but humans are humans, I suppose, so we just have to accept. And maybe it was an isolated incident. But anyway, Lord Ram overheard this man and said he was disturbed, very disturbed, probably like terrified of this conditioned soul. But because Lord Ramachandra was, his position was to establish righteousness in the world and righteous rulership, he had to act on what he heard. And to act on that, he decided that Sita Devi, even after going through all that had gone before, the whole war in Lanka, the exile in the forest for all those years, and now Lord Ramachandra abandons Sita Devi again. So Lakshman takes her to the forest and abandons her. And even though she's pregnant, so it's again, it's almost inconceivable. We need to dive deep into this to try and begin to conceive really what's going on here, because the conditioned soul might jump in this and say, what's this all about, you know? If he's such a great man, why is he throwing away his wife and she's pregnant as well? That's terrible. But this is the difference between the conditioned nature and the spiritual nature. We just have to dive into that ocean and try and understand it ourselves. So Lord Rama had one sense that was his duty, to give the good example to people. It's also a reason why if somebody is in that position now, if his wife cheats on him, perhaps he should not just act on instinct. Perhaps he should get some good advice first before he acts in a way which he might regret later. So this is it. Sita Devi, again, she's in a very difficult situation. Difficult situation to deal with. And her whole life has been really hardship and trial. So she's been rescued by the sage Valmiki, and he's given shelter, and she's given birth to Lava and Kush. So those the twins, they're educated by Valmiki Muni, and they're taught military skills, and they become very brave, intelligent warriors. They also learn music, and they're learning the Ramayana all the time, which has at its core about the life of Lord Ramachandra, but they don't know that he is their father. So it's interesting how this pastime continues, that Lord Ram, now he's completely grief-stricken, and in that state he performs a huge Ashvamedha yagya on a very grand scale. And as part of that, a horse is left to roam all around the surrounding provinces, and everywhere that horse goes without being caught, then that becomes part of the kingdom, of Lord Ram's kingdom. So when the horse comes close to the ashram of Valmiki Muni, Lava and Kush, they capture the horse effortlessly. It's not difficult for them. And immediately they become in conflict with their father, even though they don't realize they're in conflict. So the boys refuse to release the horse. So Lord Ram sends the brothers to come and fight with the boys. But the boys win easily. Then Lord Ram, he goes personally, certain that he's sure to defeat these two boys. But he's surprised by their prowess in fighting. They're great warriors. And he doesn't know that they are his sons either. So in the end, he invites them to Ayodhya. And at that point, all is revealed that he is their father and they're his sons. So when Sita realizes that her sons have been united again with their father, Lord Ram, then to her, her life mission is complete. There's nothing more to do. So even though Lord Ram, he approaches her and wants her to come back to him, but she's no longer willing to return to Lord Ram or to Ayodhya. Instead, she's choosing to seek refuge in the arms of her loving mother, who is Bhumidev, Mother Earth. So in the same way that she appeared from Mother Earth, she returns to Mother Earth. She requests Mother Bhumidev's mercy upon her to give her release from the unjust world and all the sadness that's within it. And then the earth splits open. Bhumidev comes and takes Sita's hand and takes her into the earth. Such an incredible pastime. And this ends the pastimes of the avatar Sita Devi. Very interesting. Running a bit short in time, but I just quickly want to say there's another very interesting story. When we were in India in 2010 on the sabbatical, we went to Sri Rangam in India. I don't know if anyone's been to Sri Rangam temple in South India. If you've not, you should. It's an incredible temple. It's such a vast area, and the Sri Vaishnavas have been there for a long, long, long time. But there's the beautiful deity there, the reclining Vishnu form, Sri Ranganath, very beautiful deity, long, ancient deity. It's said that this deity belonged to Lord Brahma. He requested a deity of the Lord at one time, and he was given Sri Ranganath as a deity. And then over time, he passed it down to the sun planet, and then it came down onto the earth planet. Then it was in Ayodhya for a long, long period of time. And after the Lanka War, when Ravana was dead and his brother Vibhishan was given the rulership of Lanka. So the deity was now, Lord Ram wanted to gift Sri Ranganath to Vibhishan to take him to Lanka. So the long road from Ayodhya, they came down and then they stopped at this place in South India. And then the next morning they went to go again, but the deity said, I don't want to. He spoke to his pujaris and he said, I don't want to go any further. I'm quite happy here. So Sri Ranganath, he stayed there and they continued to worship him there. But time passed, great periods of time passed, and the Sri Vaishnavas, they were often attacked by foreign forces. And at one point they were almost wiped out, the Sri Vaishnavas who were living there. And the temple containing Sri Ranganath, it became overgrown with forest and jungle, and it was completely covered over. And then at a future time, around about the time of Sri Ramanujacharya, there was a Sri Vaishnav who was just sitting on this hill one day under a tree, and a bird, a parrot, came down onto that tree on a branch and started to speak to him, this Vaishnav, and told him, beneath your feet is Sri Ranganath. And so the Vaishnav took the words of the parrot to be truth, and he started to dig down, and then he uncovered the temple, and they uncovered the temple, and there was Sri Ranganath, the deity, after who knows how many years. Because again, of course, we're talking about millions of years here. And so at the time of Ramanujacharya, the temple was fully brought back and the deity began to be worshipped again. And now it's like a huge complex. But at one point in that history, there was one of the Vaishnavas who was in charge of cultivating tulsi. So he looked after the tulsi gardens near the temple. And one time he was just in the Tulsi garden, and suddenly he unearthed a baby child, a baby girl came out from the earth. And so he took that girl and he started to look after her. He was just alone, but he started to look after her. So she grew. And one time when she was a child, she because he used to make Tulsi garlands to take to the temple for deity worship. But one time he came home and the girl had the garland around her neck and she was looking at herself and dancing around with this garland. And he was very angry with her. Sort of like, how dare you wear the garlands meant for the Lord? But that night he had a dream, and Sri Ranganath, the deity, came to him and said, "This, you mustn't chastise this girl, she's very special. In fact, from now on, every garland before you bring her to me, put her on this girl first." So the Vaishnava was, "Wow, this is incredible." So it continues. So every time he made a garland, he put it on this girl before he took it to the deity. And then time came that she was ready to be married. So he said to her one day, "Now it's time. We should find a good husband for you." And she said, "Well, there's no man on this earth who's suitable to be a husband for me. The only husband I have is Sri Ranganath." And again, the Vaishnava was thinking, "Well, what can this be?" You know. And again, that night he had a dream. And Sri Ranganath came to him and said, this is true. I will accept her as my bride. So bring her to the temple." So the girl was like inconceivably beautiful. It said she was absolutely beauty beyond compare. And so they put her in a palanquin. So no man was allowed to see her. Like, no man was allowed to set her eyes on her. The Vaishnava had protected her all this time. So they took the palanquin inside Sri Rangam, into the complex, right into the altar. And then it's that she stepped out and she lay down beside the deity and she merged into the deity. And this is written down by the Sri Vaishnavas. You know, everything is written down by them. So this actually happened. And her name is Andal. She's very famous in Sri Vaishnav culture. So again, a similar thing to Mother Sita, where she's appeared from the earth. But unlike Sita, Andal returns to her supreme lover, her point of existence, Sri Ranganath, in the same way that Radharani opened her eyes only. She didn't want to see this world, but she opened her eyes only to see Sri Krishna. So incredible pastimes. Just a little bit of time left, so I just wanted to, because it's the appearance of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur Maharaj, I thought to say a few things about his appearance. So he appeared at, on the 6th of February 1874 at 3:30 in the afternoon in Puri, one of the holiest places in India, of course, and just about a quarter mile from the Jagannath Temple. So he's the son of Srimati Bhagavati Devi and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And he showed some unusual signs right from the very beginning. Of course, it said the umbilical cord was actually wrapped around his body, like the Upavita thread, like the Brahmin thread was wrapped around his body. And actually it left a permanent mark, they say, this umbilical cord. I know that when I was born, the umbilical cord was around my neck, you know, it was turning blue, but that's different. Not quite so auspicious. And actually, so during infancy, his head seemed to be unusually large, and it said because his brain was so well developed, actually, it seemed like in comparison to his body, his head was really large. And he was very serious nature, very serious child, but incredibly intelligent. So an astrologer, of course, happened, all the time in India at that time. The astrologer looked at the natal chart and declared that the body of this boy possessed all the 32 symptoms of an exalted personage, which is very rare in the world, of course. And he also said, "I've done many horoscopes in my life, but I've never before seen one replete with all the signs of an eminent personality, this child will become world famous as a teacher of the ultimate goal of life. Very auspicious. So he was given the name Bimal Prasad, and he was the sixth child in a family of 13, and the fourth of eight sons. And this, of course, the family was very special. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, as we know, is a very exalted Vaishnav and Acharya in our line. But the whole family, he was from this Brahma Kayastha family, so they could trace their lineage right back to Lord Brahma, the Brahma Kayasthis. And Bhakti Vikash Swami comments on this. He said, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur had appeared in 1838 as the most distinguished descendant of a lineage renowned for both worldly and religious merit. With the advent of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, the family line became even more enhanced. Bhaktisiddhanta was no ordinary mortal belonging to a particular race or caste. He was neither Bengali, Indian, or Kayastha, but a resident of Vaikuntha, come to exhibit the character of the spiritual world and reclaim the fallen souls. So, you think of it, if it wasn't for Bhaktivinoda Thakur and for Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, that probably we wouldn't be here today, because at that time in India, the Sahajas had overtaken pretty much of what was left from the time of Lord Chaitanya. It had so many asampradayas, it was all being lost. So if it wasn't for those two exalted souls who preserved the absolute truth and brought it down to today, through Bhaktisiddhanta's greatest disciple, Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, we probably wouldn't be here, and we'd be in deepest ignorance, most likely. But I'll go just a little bit more. Again, in childhood, the first signs of his greatness were really at the time of the Rath Yatra, Lord Jagannath on his Rath Yatra. So he was only 5 months old. So the cart, sometimes, some years it would go quite quickly along its route, but this time it stopped for 3 days outside the house of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So at that time, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who arranged for a constant Sankirtan festival during that time, you can imagine just kirtan and prasadam, everybody in such a joyous mood. And at that time, he directed his wife to take the young Bimal Prasad onto the cart, onto the Rath cart. And when he was placed there, he said that the small child, he reached out with his little arms to touch the feet of the deity. He said, and just at that point, there was some reciprocation, because the garland fell from Lord Jagannath, right encircled the child. So this was confirmation that this was a great soul. And so on that same day, Bimal Prasad has Anaprasana ceremony, the first grain ceremony. And that was actually conducted with Jagannath's Mahaprasad. So again, very nice. And also was the ceremony of placing the baby amid the various objects, such as rice paddy, money, and scriptures, to see which one the baby will go to, which is an indication of his future propensity in life. So Bhima Prasad spontaneously went for the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this was obviously his inclination. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he prayed for an empowered soul to come into the world to help him in his mission. And when all of this came, he realized that his prayers had been answered by the Supreme Lord, that his son, Bimal Prasad, would be the one who would come to help him. So from a young age, Bhaktivinoda Thakur would take Bimal Prasad to preaching engagements, to holy places, to meet sadhus. So all the time his intelligence, which was very great, was directed directly into studying the scriptures, the Vaishnava philosophy, and also the doctrines opposed to it. So from a very young age he was learning to refute the arguments of the atheists, which is very interesting from a young age. And the young Bimal Prasad, he naturally took to such training, and he took the mood of his father, which was full surrender to Krishna and compassionate desire to inspire devotion in others. And of course the rest is all history. And like I say, we've somehow, the mercy of the Supreme Lord has come down to today through these great souls actually through Bhaktinod Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. Otherwise, we might have been given some shadow form of the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, but we've been given it direct by their mercy. So I should stop there. I don't know if anybody wants to ask something or add something. There's no breakfast, so we're not in such a huge rush. Everybody's okay. So I hope I managed to say something that was somehow honouring these great souls and honouring Sita Devi and ultimately Sri Krishna. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur Goswami Maharaj ki jai. Srila Bhaktivinoda, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Very soon.